I don't know if you have heard of the story before. This is a Chinese story.
Okay, I'm listening. Let me see if my Chinese brain is working today. Do you have anything to say about the chosen versus inherited responsibility?
I don't think I have anything intelligent to say about that.
No worries, we'll skip over that. Let's look at this wonderful drawing that I was looking at during the interview. I actually have the same birthday as Niall Horan. I used to brag about that when I was like 12 years old. By the way, you only have one Donald Trump name drop left before my channel gets banned.
Oh, good that there are so many politicians to choose from.
Hello everyone. We're here for an interview on responsibility. Episode 2 of interviewing professors about various questions. Could you just briefly introduce yourself to the audience?
Thank you so much. So my name is Ziadil Nabulsi.
My name is Thomas Hart.
My name's Jing Iris Hu.
I'm Violetta Agneski. I'm an associate professor here at McMaster University in the philosophy department.
I'm an assistant professor in the Department of Philosophy at York University in Toronto.
I'm an associate professor of philosophy at Concordia University in Montreal, Canada.
This is my second video with Olivia. I teach at Toronto Metropolitan University in the philosophy department.
The first question I have is, here is a common street definition of responsibility. Being responsible for X means being expected to fulfill X. Unless a greater responsibility arises or our ability to fulfill X is weakened to no fault of our own, responsibility also entails being held accountable if we do not fulfill X. But in our society, it seems people constantly fail to uphold responsibilities, yet also constantly escape accountability. What's going on here? Is our common definition of responsibility flawed?
As a street definition, that was a pretty cumbersome one. I think when most people think of responsibility, it stops with the I'm responsible to do X. Not doing X is counted as morally culpable or wrong or incorrect or giving up, if you like. And I think it's that street definition which is where the whole accountability thing starts to fall apart, because we're quite happy to listen to politicians saying things like, I take full responsibility, or corporate types, or whatever else. But nonetheless, they don't do anything about it. So the accountability side of it is actually undermined by claiming to accept the responsibility. So we honor them for accepting the responsibility and expect nothing more.
I take full responsibility.
Sorry, I've got to say it. Pete Hegseth is the one that comes to mind immediately, Secretary of Defense of the United States. In the instance where there was the journalist involved in the Signal chat group, full responsibility and accountability would mean resigning. And he didn't do that. He claimed that he is the Defense Department head, and so he has a greater responsibility, and this should just be ignored because he has this greater responsibility.
One thing to think about is what we mean by accountability. The kind of classical distinction would be between forward and backward-looking accounts of responsibility. Thinking about it from a Marxist perspective or something like that, you could say that really what matters is something like forward-looking responsibility. What we care about is to how to rectify your behavior, the social impacts of your behavior and so on, but we're not really punishing you because we think, you know, you have this free will which you have exercised in the incorrect way. The issue is also contemporary usage of the concept of responsibility kind of collapses it with blameworthiness or something like that, where it's to say, well, look, you know, you're responsible for this, I blame you for this, right? A lot of people would say, well, there is maybe something unhealthy about this. This obsession with guilt and punishing the guilty maybe leads us to fixate on individuals or, you know, these extreme cases, and we don't really look at the structural issues, and then we're not really thinking so much about this question of accountability as a kind of social engineering problem, which maybe would be, let's say, the Marxist way to think about this.
So I think we need to expand our definition of responsibility and think of it in two different ways. And the way I like to think about it is a difference between forward-looking responsibility in the sense of having to do something and backward-looking responsibility in the sense of being responsible or accountable for something that you've done in the past.
Something like forward-looking responsibility.
Actually, you provide both a positive and a negative definition of responsibility here. The positive one is that we are expected to fulfill something, right? And the negative one, which you define as accountability, is that when we fail to do something. And I feel like in modern society, a lot of times we're focusing on the second type. Oh, you're responsible for breaking this glass. or, oh, you are responsible for not doing something. So we're focusing on what we failed to do, which will result the kind of pessimistic outlook that, oh, we're failing our responsibilities left and right.
How do you think we should understand responsibility to navigate these kinds of details?
So we can think about concrete examples. In some sense, Hernan Cortes was responsible for the conquest of Mexico and all the depredations that attended that. But then you can talk about a kind of inherited collective responsibility, which is to say, well, look, you know, maybe the descendants of Hernan Cortes and his soldiers were not the people who actually went and destroyed the Aztec Empire, right? Or maybe we're talking about, let's say, people who were born in the 18th century in Mexico. But you could say that collective responsibility tracks something like the ongoing effects of an action. So if this action, for example, meant dispossession of indigenous people or the reduction to a state where they have to provide personal service to the Spaniards. And if you as the descendant of Hernan Cortes are, you know, you're okay with this, you're participating in this, you might say there is a collective responsibility here as descendants of this first wave of colonists. And that does seem to track something in our ordinary moral discourse. For example, individual versus collective responsibility when we're talking about war crimes. The commander-in-chief of a military or the person who gives these commands does bear some individual responsibility, right, as an individual. But of course, the commander-in-chief cannot do anything by herself or himself, right? You can't go and commit war crimes individually. You need an apparatus and a kind of collective of people who are subordinate to each other in a certain clear way and so on.
He kept saying the problem is Netanyahu. That's not true. Even Netanyahu made the point in his UN speech. He says,
I say this not only in my name or the name of my government, but on behalf of all the people of Israel.
He said there are 120 members of the Knesset. Do you know how many support the Palestinian state? He said, correctly, 9.
It's not a fringe group. It's not the prime minister who himself is extreme. It's over 90% of Israelis.
I think a lot of times responsibility falls upon us in very subtle ways. Let's say my child is in this room and all of a sudden I got called out because an emergency happened and it just becomes you and the child. In normal case, you would naturally resume the responsibility of the adult. You would not say, hey, this is not my child. There's, you know, no relationship between us. In the Confucian tradition, sometimes when we talk about responsibility, we're not really talking about, in a negative sense, what is the thing that I am responsible for. Instead, there is a sense of to respond to, which is where the word responsibility comes from. You do something for me, to me, or something happened to me, then I respond, right? It's expected of me to react in certain ways. But in what ways? For example, if I'm the older sister, you're the younger sister, and then there's another younger sister there, our responsibility would be different to that specific little sister because I happen to be the older one. So there are very specific relationships that would dictate our relationship to each other, which sounds to be a little bit uncomfortable to a lot of people because a lot of times we would like to think we all have the same responsibility, right? We have the same responsibility, but we do have different relationships to other people. We have different relationship to an extremely very situated relationship to the world, to the environment. And also the Confucians think that there is a continuity between us and our environment. So there's a continuity between how I behave, how you react, how I react to that reaction. We're playing an active role in that. So we cannot say, oh, I'm not responsible for decisions you make.
We're basically looking at the end of a century of egoism, where every human being in the West, at any rate, is meant to count themselves as sovereign individuals. Well, where I'm a sovereign individual, responsibility and what I accept as responsibility ends with me. The problem is that the concept of responsibility is not an egoistic or individualistic kind of thing. If I have a position of some sort in our society, regardless of the rank, hierarchy, or anything else, if I accept that position, that comes with a responsibility. Some are public, some are private. In interpersonal relationships, you automatically accept the responsibility for things like fidelity and honesty and things like that on an interpersonal level. Nobody else has to be involved in it, just you and the partner that you have accepted as your partner. If you happen to be a public figure, a philosophy professor, or a politician, or a doctor, or a lawyer for that matter, there is an understanding of responsibility as something much greater than the individual. You're reaching to a higher moral order, if you like, and there it still requires your individual acceptance of that responsibility. Now, you might say people don't have to accept all of the details of every job application or whatever, but normally speaking, that ends you as that kind of a person. You're no longer a lawyer if you don't abide by the ethics and the responsibility codes of lawyers. You're not a doctor if you don't abide by those. You're not a professor if you don't abide by those. So the individual, in a sense, is kind of contractually obligated to accept the responsibility and do what is required in those circumstances.
How are the concepts of responsibility and accountability related to each other?
Even if I tell you, I believe that people don't really have this free will and this strong metaphysical sense which initiates causal chains, but I might still say accountability is useful because it's a way of organizing our society in a certain way. I might say, look, I don't hold you as guilty in this strong sense of you freely chose to commit murder, but I do think that I have to show to other people that it's not okay to murder people. And Hegel, for example, famously says, well, actually, the criminal as this human being calls for punishment, to have their humanity recognized. So if you're not really punishing them by taking them to be guilty in this strong sense, because they were responsible, because they could have chosen to do otherwise, then you're degrading people. You're subject to conditioning in the same way that, you know, a dog or a crocodile is. But you could also look at it the other way and to say, look, you know, humans are just animals. That's fine. There's nothing that special about humans. You know, for example, in Canada, when they have like grizzly bears that go into places in Alberta near people, they do what I think what they call like active deterrence. You just want this bear to have this association. Well, okay, I see people, I'm in this campground, I get this really unpleasant feeling. You're punishing the bear to deter it, but you're not taking the bear to be responsible in a strong sense and say, you know, bear, I'm going to punish you. Of course, we have the history of medieval trials of animals, I mean, which is pretty fascinating. But that's a case where people thought, okay, no, I could actually put a bear on trial and so on.
Oh yeah, didn't they have pigs on trial?
Yes.
And things? Okay, right.
Yeah, so if a pig, for example, ate your crop, you would ask who's responsible, and then the pig would be put on trial and so on.
Did they have lawyers?
I have no idea.
Okay.
You know, you need to.
I'm going to look this up. I'm going to look this up.
They sometimes had lawyers, but my source is Wikipedia, so I DK.
Accountability is not a separate thing from responsibility, so you can't have accountability.
Sorry, do you want to wait a second for the plane? We always have interruptions in our interviews. I don't know why. Last time it was the blender.
Yep. You're going to wait a second for the blender. So for those philosophical.
Okay.
Somebody who tries to avoid the accountability for a responsibility that they have accepted either simply hasn't understood what it means to be responsible, or they find the accountability distasteful and would like the privilege of the responsibility, but not the consequence of the responsibility. One of the things that I find bizarre about the way the internet culture works is that people who feel that they have been slighted want to hold someone accountable, but no one on the internet believes that they have a responsibility of any sort. If I'm a content creator, if you're a content creator, there's a certain degree to which your own personal set of rules, ethics, responsibilities kick in. Nobody else can really hold you accountable to it because the function of the internet is to create a layer of anonymity, regardless of personality or not. Just go onto Instagram and look at content creators that are really just trying to produce clicks. No reasonable person would expect these people to act the way that they are on Instagram in person. And so that kind of creates this idea that I'm not really responsible for what it is that I'm doing on the internet, but what I'm doing on the internet can cause harm. It's a basic principle in our society that causes harm gives you the responsibility of reparation of some sort. If I'm going onto the internet to create content, I'm doing so in a kind of quid pro quo. Hopefully I get enough clicks that I'm going to end up making money out of this. I'll get sponsors. I can give up my day job. Everything's happy. That in itself is accepting a responsibility. And so once you have slighted someone, even if it is not your personal personality, you are still responsible, it seems to me.
Question three. When and where does the binary break down between individual versus collective responsibility and also chosen and inherited responsibility?
When you talk about this binary, I think it's really important to remember, if we talk about collectives, the individual is not outside of the collective, they're a part of the collective. And we really need to think of ourselves as part of the collective. And of course, if we're not part of the collective in an active way, we should become part of the collective. So keeping them very distinct as concepts is really misleading, and it's not very helpful in terms of facilitating action to do something.
Yeah, let me try to say something that's not totally bland here.
Oh, be blunt. Be honest. We want honesty.
I think it's interesting because, you know, there are cases where you could say, look, somebody thinks that their country is doing something really bad. It's financing a genocide, for example. Of course, me as an individual, I'm not more responsible than you. Let's say, you know, we're both, we have regular jobs that aren't in the military industrial complex, 9 to 5, normal jobs. Olivia doesn't have more responsibility than I do. But in some cases, people come to think, well, actually, precisely because nobody's acting on this, then I have to take on more responsibility myself. Take on the burden of, you know, maybe doing something very direct, interfering with a weapons plant or so on. From the standpoint of justice, maybe you're taking on more than you should, but as a matter of fact, your society isn't responding in the adequate way. And I think that's a really interesting, complex case, because that's a case where actually the individual comes to say there's this collective responsibility. You people are not acting accordingly. I'm going to take on this individual responsibility on behalf of you.
We have to admit that when things need collective effort, we need better organization. You can't just do one thing, like, because you do this, I do this, 2 plus 2, and then, you know, a bunch of individuals together. That's not a collective. The problem with collective responsibility is that there seems to be a very vague resolution out of it, in the sense that what exactly is expected of each individual of this group. As a group, you need to apologize for what you did, for this group has done in the past. Who is the spokesperson of this group? Do each and every single person of this group need to apologize and acknowledge the wrong? And then do each and then every single individual of this group, should they do something to repair it? And what form would that take? There is this phenomenon, I think, that has become a hot topic online also. It's called the elder child syndrome. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
Elder, oh, like
the oldest.
Oh,
the
gotcha.
Oldest.
Yeah. Oh, me.
Okay.
I've seen this before as an elder child. Yeah.
Yeah. The oldest child syndrome, meaning that for whatever reason, you still assume responsibility that the younger siblings would not necessarily have.
Yes.
So in this case, you didn't inherit it, but by being born the first child of the family, you kind of just have this responsibility, and you can't easily give it to someone else either, right? We have this assumption that if we are free, then all decisions we make should be free, and then the consequences should come from decisions that we made. We don't feel very comfortable to think about, oh, actually there are things we have no choice at all, and I still have to happily take upon moral consequence. They're not necessarily suppressive roles, but they are particular roles and relationships that we were either born into or we sometimes just take on without really thinking that I chose this. So if I were the only and first woman professor in my profession, I may not have chose to be that. I may have wanted more people to be like that before me so I can just follow their path.
Right.
But I would still be proudly to take upon that role.
And so let's say the woman is responsible for doing all the housework and all the child rearing. If someone were to say, that's not fair, I inherited this responsibility, I didn't choose it. And then we could give some kind of an argument to show why, even though society or within, say, the family, that responsibility is placed on that person, that's an incorrect placement of responsibility. Other times I might say something like, well, I don't care about people living in poverty. I don't live in poverty, or I don't care about the environment because I'm gonna die. And I, you know, if I don't have children, I don't care what happens after I live. There, I don't think you could make that kind of a claim because, again, these, I believe, are morally mandatory things that you don't have to opt into just by being a human being.
You've already stated a lot of the problems, or I guess difficulties, with collective responsibility. Understandably, some people as a result are quite pessimistic about collective responsibility. On a metaphysical level, some argue that the concept of responsibility can't map onto groups the same way they can onto individuals. For example, claiming that the group is not a distinct entity, it just is the sum of a bunch of individuals. They might argue that collective responsibility violates principles of fairness. Why should I be expected to fulfill a responsibility just because of mere group membership? So how do you react to pessimism about collective responsibility?
Right. So I think there is, you know, the worry about fairness, I think, is a legitimate worry. And you see it today, especially when people talk about racism and anti-racism and responses to that. People say, well, look, you know, maybe my ancestors enslaved people, but I didn't. So, I mean, do you want me to feel guilty about this? Do you want me to pay reparations?
Look. Obviously, imperialism was bad, but it's humanity. I mean, what are we going to do? Huh? Really? Should we give away all our money?
There are several ways to respond to this, right? One way to think about this is to re-describe the action that we're talking about and to say, actually, it's ongoing. Actually, we're not talking about an event that started at point T1, terminated at T2, where T2 was 200 years ago, and that's it. We're talking about maybe systematic injustice against a certain group, which is a kind of ongoing process. You are, in a sense, participating in this action or process by virtue of being a member of a certain group, which gives you certain privileges at the expense of certain people. Let's say, you know, I'm the heir of a really big estate. Let's say the estate is in somewhere in the Caribbean and it grew to, as a result of slavery. And you might say, of course, well, look, you know, Ziad, you didn't go and enslave the people and so on. But there is a sense in which I continue to benefit at their expense. There is some responsibility that's being inherited insofar as I'm taking responsibility and taking a position of saying this is mine to this physical wealth that I've acquired. The interesting case would be to think of, can somebody disavow responsibility by saying, look, this money, I don't want it. I don't want the burdens that come with it. I am going to redistribute it. And that's it. Don't come and ask me any questions about this stuff. That would be, I think, an interesting case to think about.
There was a film done by the NFB called The Corporation. And it's well worth looking at that if anybody's got the time. It's the National Film Board of Canada. It was an absolutely fantastic film that psychoanalyzes corporations. It looks at the corporation as an individual, which is how they are legally treated.
Right, yeah, yeah.
And then psychoanalyzes the behavior of corporations within our society. And it fits in here because, well, the conclusion is that corporations are psychopaths because they do not accept responsibility for any of the actions that they take, but they do want the status of legal individuals. If you are a member of a collective, then you have to be willing to accept the responsibility for what that collective portrays, promotes, does, etc. If you aren't willing to do that, then you shouldn't count yourself as a member of that collective.
It seems what you're getting at is that a lot of people think of identity as something static or passive that just happens to them, or that they just, I don't know, inherit in some way, versus thinking of identity that is sustained through actions, through ways of being.
Yeah, this is obviously in the 20th century in philosophy, this is sort of a central divide, mm-hmm. in certain respects between analytic philosophy and more sort of continentally or existentially oriented philosophy. The position that I hold is essentially there is no such thing as a self, certainly not in the static sense that endures from time to time and I can count on all the time, right. Or you can count on in me all the time. I am what it is that I do. You can't claim an identity, have nothing to do with that identity, and then assert that identity later on without doing the things that are entailed by that identity. To quote Michel Foucault, or sort of quote Michel Foucault, we tend to think that the politicians and the bureaucrats are going to keep our papers in order. That is, I have a driver's license with my name and my birth date. I have a birth certificate, I have a health card, I have a passport. And we tend to think of that somehow as tied to identity. But clearly, if none of those things existed, you would still have an identity because all of those things are modern inventions. So when we think of identity as a static thing, we are going to fail in our responsibilities because we will attach responsibilities to some other version of ourselves.
I think with moral motivation, if we're all in this, we're all going to do that. That brings some kind of partnership. But if we're asking who is responsible if this thing goes wrong, that already sours the relationship. It's the same way to certain people in certain culture, if we're going to dinner together, and before we even sat down, and I started to say, hey, you're responsible for all the things you ordered, okay? And I'm only responsible for the things I order. Is that okay?
Oh, that would not fly under my family.
Right? So it's not that the question itself is not legitimate, right? It's that the very act of bringing up the division of accountability would sometimes sour a conversation, especially like a collaborative relationship. Like when I leave the room, I don't say, hey, Olivia, can I trust you not drink my water? That would just be a very strange thing to do. And then instead of increase the trust, it would actually make you put a thought into your mind. It was like, why does she think I'm going to drink her water? The very act of naming all the ways you could betray my trust is a sign of not trusting.
Question number 5. Sometimes valuable results would only happen if there is widespread collective action. For instance, if starting tomorrow I went vegan, only took public transport, and replaced my paper towel with reusable towels, but majority of the population continued living as they do, I would basically produce no effect on the environment.
Do people still have a personal responsibility to do the right thing in these cases?
If somebody goes back in time and says, well, if I refrain from buying sugar that has been cultivated using slave labor, is this really a big deal? Well, what's going to happen, right? Because there were these debates about sugar boycotts in the 18th century, for example. And you could say, of course, yeah, you individually, Olivia or Ziad, boycotting sugar, it's not going to lead to the collapse of plantation slavery. But what we do know is individual actions like that can become a catalyst for broader social changes. And then insofar as you have a responsibility, you could say you have a responsibility to do the best you can do to, in this case, avert total ecological collapse on the planet, right? So the stakes are pretty high. Some boycotts did have a substantive effect. So the South African boycott, that had a very big effect in terms of isolating South Africa, undermining the legitimacy of apartheid, and actually was actually a generalized boycott. It was a boycott against South African individuals, South African organizations, so basically anybody with a South African passport. I mean, I'm neutral on the veganism stuff. I'm not a vegan. Maybe I ought to be a vegan, but you know, I like steaks and stuff, so it's a problem for me.
They did not just consume it either, brother. They took pleasure from this.
When we're talking about our responsibility, the consequences are not the only important moral consideration. I think that there are other moral important considerations. Care and caring for other people, people that we're in relationships with, people that we're in community with, other people on the planet. Care is a morally charged concept. Being a good person, doing the right thing, are morally important, even if we can't show a huge impact on the consequences.
I think you're right. A lot of the actions nowadays would have to come from upstream, meaning either the government or bigger corporations. That individuals are pretty insignificant, right, in terms of the changes, right? There was a movement about not using straws, and then each of us did our part. But then there are also studies that came out to say, actually, that was not necessarily a very useful thing that we did, other than making drinking bubble tea impossibly difficult, right?
Imagine trying to drink it with a spoon.
Yeah, and or with the paper straw.
Right.
It's just, yeah, it's not the same. But in personal level, we should resist the temptation to be morally oblivious, meaning that I just think, oh, it has nothing to do with me. You know, I'm just going to do my thing until the government tells me otherwise. I think that's not a good position to have. We should definitely inform ourselves so that we know at least the consequences of things.
The idea comes from the 1960s. It was very popular. The notion of critical mass. It may very well be the case that you have absolutely no impact on the environment by stopping using paper towels and things like that. But the problem is you can guarantee that there will be no impact on the environment if you don't change the way that you act. So whether or not you are the one that causes the whole change in the environmental situation is irrelevant to how you act in the world.
Question 6. Have you seen narratives of personal responsibility weaponized for problematic ends?
Yeah, I mean, a lot. This is bad because it shows how often I'm on Twitter or X, but, you know, maybe we'll call it
not
research.
Not on Blue Sky, is that what it's called?
I'm other not one? On Blue Sky. Okay. I decided, you know, if X or Twitter implodes, which it is, you know, I'll just give up on that stuff, you know, I think that's... But anyway, I mean, on X, you see this weaponization of individual responsibility. Your life sucks because you don't grind hard enough, you don't eat enough protein.
Where's your pure protein box? Is it,
yeah,
is it here? Oh,
yeah,
no,
I
it's hidden.
It.
It's hidden.
It.
Okay.
It. I mean, I think you should get enough protein. I think that's important. But I don't think you should use that to explain, you know, why people are depressed. I mean, you see people neglecting structural elements such as, for example, student debt, especially in the United States. You can grind really hard, but if you have to pay $3,000 a month in student debt, and most of that is going to the interest, this is not something that you can do with kind of individual willpower. And you see it, of course, again, the way it's being used when people talk about families. Young couples or young families are not having children because you're not good enough, you're abandoned traditional social roles. But in fact, of course, it's pretty obvious to anyone that the reason that there is a decrease in the birth rate amongst this demographic is because it's so expensive to have a child. That's moving away from structural issues to say, well, there is something really wrong with, you know, your mental makeup.
The thing that comes right to mind is the manosphere, this absolutely detestable notion that masculinity has something to do with asserting dominance, and that if you are not asserting your dominance as a male, then you are not a male. It's just completely absurd, because most of what it is that is asserted in terms of that dominance is not helpful to anybody other than the alpha male. male. And so you get to these Ponzi schemes where the alpha male online encourages behavior in others out in society, but takes no responsibility for what is happening there. Any Ponzi scheme has someone benefiting at the top from everybody else's participation in it. The notion of responsibility as your masculine responsibility being used for wickedly problematic gains. You could see it back in the 1990s and the early 2000s in Britain when you got this backlash against a sort of rising prominence of feminist literature and feminist ideology in the UK with the reaction of what was called then called lad culture.
Lad culture?
Yeah. Soft porn magazines where, you know, it was just the latest models in the least amount of clothing that they could get away with without being called porn. FHM, GQ, all of these magazines sort of established themselves within this. Esquire was another one. And what they were doing was telling men it's right to look at women as objects, because in order to assert your masculinity, you have to push back against femininity. These dichotomies are complete absurdities. They fit a narrative of, well, everything is right or everything is wrong. I change everything or I change nothing. That's not how change happens.
All right. This is a long question, so just bear with me. But question 7. There have been frequent debates online about the extent to which we should hold celebrities and other social media public figures responsible for harmful political opinions or political apathy. So I'll present some points that I've seen people make.
Okay.
Some people say the public shouldn't attribute political responsibility to celebrities or influencers because they never claim to care or be knowledgeable about certain issues. I think there's a principle of consent behind this thought, in the sense that celebrities never signed on to holding political responsibilities. Like most jobs, you are only responsible for what you agree to do, and celebrities and influencers did not agree to voicing political opinions when they gained a public platform. There are others who say that even if celebrities and influencers had some political responsibilities, we wouldn't want them to be fulfilled. We should be looking to those who have education in and experience on a given political issue, such as activists or professors. A rich LA influencer probably isn't going to give us good takes anyway. On the flip side, some people have argued that celebrities and social media figures and, you know, Bill Gates and billionaires, they should be politically vocal by virtue of their large platform. They have much more influence than the average Joe, which automatically confers certain responsibilities onto them. I even wrote the quote that you just said there.
Kind of like what's said in the Spider-Man, right? With great power comes greater responsibility.
Spider-Man, what do you think the responsibility of celebrities and social media figures are?
It's too quick to say something like celebrities should have no responsibility because they didn't sign on to it. As I've said earlier, I do think that human beings sign on to things implicitly even if they don't explicitly sign on to. Now, does that mean I think that they all should become activists? No. Sometimes celebrities may be knowledgeable about certain things, and they might have certain impacts by bringing awareness to a global problem. So imagine they're trying to raise money to help people who have lost their homes in the LA fires. I would have no worry about that, but if you're following certain influencers or celebrities that are providing very technical answers to like very difficult problems, I think people should do their own research to figure out, is this a correct way of thinking about things? So I just don't think people should follow other people blindly.
You know, this one is hard, of course, because you could say, you know, a lot of celebrities, you know, should be thankful that they don't open their mouth more often. But you could push that back and say, well, aren't they responsible for educating themselves about certain issues? To bring it back to the principle of consent, it also depends on how they present themselves. Can we mention names? Those
go
people
for it. If you're okay with their fanboys.
Yeah,
fan,
I mean, I don't think I'm important enough to be attacked, right? The reason, for example, that some people might take issue with somebody like Beyonce or Jay-Z is partially because the way they've presented themselves, the kind of commercialization of a certain political aesthetic, if you will. So you see Beyoncé appealing to this kind of black radical heritage of the Black Panther Party, but then the substance is a bit different. You've presented yourself as somebody who's socially engaged. And then in that case, you could say you voluntarily placed yourself in a position where people will then say, actually, wait, do you really know what you're talking about here? Are you fulfilling your responsibilities? Other cases would be, you know, if somebody's just an athlete who, you know, doesn't really care about anything. It's not that this person is evil, but doesn't present themselves as politically engaged, doesn't use that to make money or anything like that. They train, they play the game. I think that's trickier to say, well, where would the obligation to voice political views come from. Partially is because we construct these celebrities as almost people who we have an intimate relationship with, even though that's obviously not the case. But you see, people have these kind of parasocial relations with celebrities. They think, well, you should be moved by what moves me, you should speak about what really makes me angry, even if the celebrity in question doesn't even know that you exist, right? Well, of course, there are celebrities who took very seriously this idea of social responsibility. I mean, Marlon Brando is a great example, right? I mean, he was one of the few kind of A-list celebrities who was very supportive of indigenous rights in the United States. We could also think of somebody like Muhammad Ali, of course, was very active in opposition to the Vietnam War and so on, and had a very clearly articulated argument as to why he's not going to go fight in Vietnam.
Have you seen the discourse around Sabrina Carpenter's album cover?
I mean, I saw a little bit. Is it the like sexual poses stuff? I didn't really...
So it's a picture of... Actually, I can just search it up here.
Right.
Oh, wait. I don't have internet. I just realized. Okay, whatever.
Anyway.
But in that certain case, unlike Beyonce, Sabrina Carpenter, I don't think intended to say anything political,
right,
and yet it came off that way to a lot of people. And then she had to be like, I wasn't thinking about any of that when I made this album,
right,
cover.
But it's interesting in that case, because you could say, well, surely you do have some responsibility to anticipate how people will take it up. Even just from an instrumental marketing perspective, you might say, okay, how are people going to make sense of this? Are you responsible for understanding the effects of your action in the public,
right,
sphere?
Yeah.
And it seems to me you should be responsible. I find it a bit hard when people say, well, look, I didn't intend anything, because then you're saying, I don't really care enough about what anyone thinks to have thought about this, which,
right,
I find it's a bit of an odd attitude.
Human beings who evolved to live in small moral communities, and then now we're post-industrialization, of course we live in a bigger community, but we're not very used to the speed and then the scope of how things get spread over on social media, which means that we are not very capable of managing the consequences. Like, if I accidentally drop your computer on the ground, I can instantly ask you if it's okay, if it's broken, I can pay for it, or I can try to repel it.
That would be the fourth time I broke this laptop, by the way.
So there's something that can be done, the consequence that I can kind of like see and manage. But for the social media, it's like you throw a ball into the space and you don't see it coming back. So there's the consequence, a lot of times is way out of our control and then way out what we could possibly foresee.
The internet is something that has changed, if you like, the traditional dynamics of the nature of responsibility and public being a public figure, right? So back in the 30s, 40s or whatever, when Betty Davis was very popular, she had a huge platform because she was the number one actress in the United States. So everybody went to see her movies. She didn't do any activism, and so she didn't hold any political clout and wasn't really responsible for any political views. On the other hand, you get people like George Clooney, who have decided that they are going to weigh in on politics because they have a platform. They wouldn't be doing it if they were a garbage collector or whatever else, because that platform wouldn't exist. And so when somebody like George Clooney steps up and says, okay, Joe Biden shouldn't be running for president, or I think that environmental issues are particularly important, they have accepted the responsibility of that political view.
In Noam Chomsky's book, Who Rules the World, he writes at one point, intellectuals are typically privileged, privilege yields opportunity, and opportunity confers responsibilities. Question number 8, how do you interpret this sentence and what do you think about it?
The thing about privilege that's important to know is that people who are privileged, they didn't just get their privileged status because they're so smart and so great. They got their privileged status because they were supported by other people in the community. They got their privileged status because they had probably other advantages that other people didn't have. And so I think that you get responsibility because of that as well. But I think we need to be careful about that. What you don't want are the affluent coming in with this savior complex and saying, we're the affluent ones, we have the higher capacity, so we should make all the changes. What we want is to make sure we, and this is an idea that Monique DeVoe raises in a recent book on poor-led poverty movements. We need to put the poor at the center of a response.
What Chomsky's saying is somebody who works a 12-hour shift in the coal mines, their time for reading about what's happening is limited. They have to take care of themselves. If you have kids, you have to physically recover. For the most part, academics in North America, if you're tenured or on tenure track, for the most part, you actually are not overworked, right? You know, academics like to complain about being overworked all the time. I mean, it's kind of pathetic, really, to be honest, but it's sad. Really.
You tell them.
Because most of my friends, personally, are non-academics, right? So I know people who work 9-to-5 jobs that they don't like. Sometimes it's 9-to-7 as well. I've never worked 9-to-7 as an academic, to be honest. And you might say with that freedom, you're able to do more. And so if responsibility is also tracking your ability to do something, then you could say intellectuals maybe have more responsibility because you do have the time to read and study about this stuff. And you see it, you know, in contemporary debates where people say, I don't really know about X. See it, of course, in the debates about Palestine today. Don't know if I'm allowed to say that.
Yeah, you can say it.
People say, well, look, I don't know enough about this topic. And I'm here, people, I'm talking about academics. You live in a state that's a direct participant in what's happening, and you have a lot of time to actually learn about this stuff. So it's a bit baffling when people say, I don't really have time.
I'd say that Chomsky is wrong on the second to the third conjunct there. Opportunity does not create responsibility. It may, but it doesn't necessarily. If I have the opportunity to go out trick-or-treating on Halloween, that doesn't create any responsibilities whatsoever. I'm not responsible for entertaining people when they say trick, not treat. I'm not responsible for choosing the right kind of candy to take from various people and all the rest of it. Some opportunities may fall into your lap. That's the side of the 1% and the 10% and all the rest of it that I don't think we really have any ability to deal with. Family privileges will provide opportunities to their offspring and their nepotistic behaviors and all the rest of it. But the individual who creates an opportunity for themselves doesn't necessarily at the same time create a responsibility. That opportunity's acceptance entails responsibility.
Okay, and last question. A lot of people ask for this video topic, I think, because especially with the younger generation, there's a feeling that everything is doomed, so why try to be responsible for others or the planet or myself? So, as our last question, do you have any advice for the tired doomerist viewers?
What you're describing is some kind of fatigue. Some people call it empathy fatigue. It happens to nurses or doctors, a lot of times healthcare providers. But I think nowadays it also happens to general people. But other than empathy fatigue, I think there's also maybe outrage fatigue, that you just can't be angry at things anymore because there's so many outrageous things in the world. It's a kind of tiredness, because as human beings, our emotions and our energy is limited. We cannot have this unlimited, you know, energy and attention, no matter how profound and how meaningful the causes are. On the other hand, I think there are a number of other things. One is we are getting better educated. As a college student or a high school student, we get to know the injustice that is happening in the other end of the world. Unlike someone of your age living in the 18th century Scotland, right? They may not know. They know how to, you know, work on the farm, but not necessarily what's happening in the Qing dynasty in China or something like that, right? We care more about things that does not directly involve me or my cousins, right? So I think we're also adapting to that reality. We like to think there's always something we can do about it, right? And even if there's nothing, then at least we can suffer with them to make it feel like they're not lonely in their suffering. For me, the important thing, and maybe for Mencius, and maybe just for me, and I'm misquoting him.
Just for you too.
Yeah, I think the important thing is to make sure the motivation would be alive, to be there next time if something happens like that. That emotional soft spot would be there. I think to me that is the most important thing compared to constantly being occupied by feeling the emotion without being able to act on it. And perhaps I'll smuggle in a little bit of the Taoist, right? A little bit of Zhuangzi, is that life is limited, but new information. Well, he didn't say new information, okay? I'm going to misquote him here. New information is unlimited, like the oceans, unlimited. If you use what's limited to pursue what is unlimited, that's very dangerous.
Not only do I have kids of my own, so I think about this idea of not being overly pessimistic and hoping to be able to encourage them to do something. I teach many students, undergraduate students, and we talk about this too. And it's difficult not to be somewhat down and depressed, but I really hope that some people are able to get themselves to do something, partly because it's your responsibility and you have an obligation to do so, but also because it's in your self-interest to do so. Because if everyone gave up, what kind of a future would we have?
I'm very sympathetic to this notion that, okay, we're screwed anyway. But then I think also of what I'm doing and what most people are doing, which is not much, to be honest. And then you think of people who are in much more difficult positions, economically and so on, and even physically, maybe they have chronic illnesses and so on, and who are doing a lot more. That makes you think, well, actually, maybe I'm not really doing enough. And I think partially what has happened is we've had a misunderstanding of history, where we've come to think that actually these positive political and social developments, which we admire, they happened relatively easy. And so we have an unrealistic understanding of what it takes to actually enact positive change. You might think, well, one issue with calling on people to do certain things is it puts them at risk. Want me to talk about this, but I'll lose my job. But what seems to have happened to is we've actually, the bar has become lower and lower. I won't get this opportunity to advance in my job. So now we're actually not talking about you losing your job, but now we're talking about you losing a potential opportunity to get a raise or something. Right. So I think that's problematic.
At some point, people can justify anything, really.
Yeah, of course, because I could say, look, you know, you want me to talk about this, but actually I was invited to this really nice dinner. And if I talk about this, I'm not going to go to this really nice dinner. That's going to make me really sad. So I do think you do have this duty, just out of self-regard, really, to say, well, look, you know, I'm not going to be this kind of entity who can just be used in certain ways, and I have no idea what's going on, being manipulated for political purposes, social purposes. And I think there's something degrading in that, right? And if you allow yourself to be in that position, there is something that's, you know, you're almost participating in your self-degradation.
How does one impose a duty onto oneself?
I mean, that's one of those very difficult questions that maybe if I had a good answer to it, maybe I'll be famous. You know, the reason I'm not famous and we're sitting here in my office is because I don't have a smart answer to it.
For example, in the environmental sphere, because you can't change everything doesn't mean that you shouldn't change anything. I used to live in the Netherlands, and in the Netherlands, you're allowed to buy electricity from many different companies. I remember talking to a friend of mine and saying, well, I was going with this one particular company that said they produce 30% of their electricity through renewables. And he kind of scoffed at me and said, how do you know that? And my response was, well, I know that in our society, if things are invested in, they become more part of the society. And so I can guarantee that they won't become part of the society if nobody invests in them. I'm not changing the world by choosing that company versus another company, but I am making a statement. And when I make that statement, I allow myself the responsibility to reflect on my own activity in the world and be proud of it. No matter how much change outside you are going to make by your actions, all of the small changes increase your humanity. And we need a lot more humanity than we've currently got.
Do you know what this means?
I think I do, but I'm not going to. See, okay. In my generation, what it was on Kids in the Hall, I squeezed your brains. It was a thing in Kids in the Hall. The dorky kid would always be sitting at the end of the schoolyard.
Oh.
Like, I crash you, I crash.
I'm only crushing your heads.
Now it means I'm clapping for you.
Yes. Okay, you know. You're in on the lingo. Okay, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you to my wonderful Patreons who support this channel. I could not do this without you. Ahmed Yazin, Anti-Oedipus, or Oedipus, if I'm going to be accurately German. Oedipus? I hope I said that right. Bonzo, Burrow Fiddle, Cyrus Orion, Dale Angelo, Dane Schneider, Dhruv Singhal, Dumple, Farman Panu, Francis X Stefanik, Harmony, I'm Curious, John Moody, Joseph Rachman, Zhao Goncalves, Justin Hollingsworth, Louis Lusignan, Horace, Ricardo, Rohan Prasad, Sean C, Survivor Soul, Victor Pahuamba, William Bowen, Wubulisi, ZKH.